American Indians and the American government have lived with a harsh legacy for 130 years. The government took tens of thousands of Indian children far away from their reservations to schools where they were required to dress, pray, work, and speak as mainstream Americans. Many Indians remember those boarding schools as places where they were abused and where their culture was desecrated. After years of reforms, the government still operates a handful of off-reservation boarding schools, but funding is in decline, and now some Native Americans are fighting to keep the schools open. NPR's Charlotte Bear has the first of two reports.
The late performer and Indian activist Floyd Red Crow Westerman was haunted by his memories of boarding school. As a child, he left his reservation in South Dakota for the Wahpeton Indian Boarding School in North Dakota. 60 years later, he still remembered watching his mother through the window of the government bus.
My first impression, I thought my mother didn't want me. And it just hit me hard like that. But when I got in the bus and I sat down, I looked, and she was just crying. It was hurting her, too. It was hurting me to see that. I'll never forget. All the mothers were crying.
Westerman's music summed up the feelings of generations of former boarding school students.
You put me in your boarding school, make me learn your white man rule, be a fool.
The federal government began sending American Indians to boarding schools in the late 1870s, when the United States was still at war with Indians. An Army officer, Richard Pratt, founded the first school that took children far from their reservations. He based it on an education program he had developed in an Indian prison. He described his philosophy in this speech, read by an actor.
A great general has said that the only good Indian is a dead one. In a sense, I agree with the sentiment, but only in this, that all the Indian there is in the race should be dead. Kill the Indian in him and save the man.
In the 1940s, this philosophy was still common. Bill Wright, a Butuan Indian, left his reservation in California for the Stewart Indian School in Nevada when he was six. Wright says matrons bathed him in kerosene and shaved his head. Students at federal boarding schools were forbidden to express their culture, everything from wearing long hair to speaking even a single Indian word. Wright says he lost not only his language, but his native name.
And I remember coming home, and, you know, then my grandma asked me to talk Indian to me, and I told her, Grandma, I don't understand you. She says, then who are you? I went, my name's Billy. She said, your name not Billy. She said, your name is Dutton. That's who you are. That's your name. And I went, not what they told me.
The intent of the school was to completely transform people. I mean, inside out. Language, religion, family structure, economics, the way you make a living, the way you express emotion, everything.
Chanina Lomawaima heads the American Indian Studies Program at the University of Arizona. She says from the start, the government's objective to erase and replace Indian culture was part of a larger strategy to conquer Indians.
They very specifically targeted Native nations that were the most recently hostile. There was a very conscious effort to recruit the children of leaders, and this was also explicit, essentially to hold those children hostage. The idea was it was going to be much easier to keep those communities pacified with their children held in a school somewhere far away.
The government operated more than 100 boarding schools for American Indians, both on and off reservations. Children were sometimes taken forcibly by armed police. Lomawaima says other families were willing to let their children go.
For many communities, for a whole variety of reasons, federal school was the only option. Public schools in many places of the country were closed to Indians because of racism.
At the boarding schools, most students learned trades, carpentry for boys and housekeeping for girls.
It wasn't really about education. We didn't really learn English, basic English or math.
Lucy Toledo, who's Navajo, went to the Sherman Institute in California in the 1950s. She also remembers some unsettling free time activities.
Saturday night, we have a movie. Every Saturday night, you know what the movie was about? Cowboys and Indians. Cowboys and Indians. Yeah, we're getting all our people killed. That's the kind of stuff they showed us.
And for decades, there were reports that students in the boarding schools were abused. Children were beaten, malnourished, and forced to do heavy labor. In the 1960s, a congressional report found that many teachers still saw their role as civilizing Native students, not educating them. The report said the schools had a, quote, major emphasis on discipline and punishment. Bill Wright remembers an advisor hitting a student hard.
Bust his head open and got blood all over, and I had to take him to the hospital, and they told me to tell him that he ran into the wall, and I better not tell him what really happened.
Wright says he still has nightmares from the severe discipline. He worries that he and other former students have inadvertently recreated that harsh environment within their own families.
It's mostly you do what I tell you, you jump. When I tell you to jump, you don't talk back. So you grow up with discipline. But when you grow up and you have families, so what happens? If you was my daughter and if you left your dress over there, you know I'll knock you through that wall. Why? Because I'm taught discipline. Then you go like, ooh, man, better behave. But you have to look what they've done to us.
Not all Indians had negative experiences at boarding schools. Some have fond memories of meeting spouses and making lifelong friends. But the scathing government reports led to the closure of most of the boarding schools. One school that remains is Sherman Indian High School in Riverside, California, the same boarding school Lucy Toledo attended. Herschel Martinez and a group of his friends gather casually in a school hallway and begin a drum circle. The school encourages Native activities like this. That's one reason Martinez feels more comfortable here than at his former public school in Los Angeles.
And everyone was wondering what nationality, what race am I? And I tell them, like, oh, wow, you're Indian. You're, like, the only guy I know that's Native. But here at Sherman, they know how I feel about being Native, and they understand where we're all coming from.
But a recent change in federal budgeting means the off-reservation boarding schools are receiving less money, and their future is in doubt. Charla Bear, NPR News.
Tomorrow, we'll have more about Native American boarding schools today and what their future might be. You can learn more about the history of the boarding schools and see a photograph of one class on its first day and then how it looked 4 months later at npr.org. The jokes we've just been hearing from Hillary Clinton and her supporters are sugar sweet compared to the political humor traditionally found along the campaign trail. Humor like the response Senator Daniel Webster made back in 1828 when he was offered the vice presidency.
It's often considered a nothing job, and Webster said, "I do not propose to be buried until I am dead." That's one of the quips from a collection titled, "I'll Be Sober in the Morning," which puts together many great political one-liners.
The title comes from a particularly biting comment from a master of political wit, Winston Churchill. As the book's editor, Chris Lamb, warns, political put-downs are not for the faint of heart.
The wit here is very mean-spirited. A good comeback. I mean, you want to leave your opponent red-faced and stammering and left sort of pick up the pieces of their manhood in a thimble and go skulking off in silence.
Well, and Winston Churchill is among those who show up with some frequency because he had loads of these great comebacks.
Yeah, Winston Churchill is sort of the star of the book. You know, Churchill could be so cruel, and he would use his humor definitely as a weapon. And, you know, the response that he had with Nancy Astor, the American-born politician in England, once shouted at Churchill and said, you know, if you were my husband, I'd put poison in your coffee. And Churchill's response was, if I were your husband, I'd drink it.
It's hard not to laugh, but there's definitely an edge to a lot of these. The famously intellectual Adlai Stevenson back in the 50s offered a timeless take and not a very nice one on the voter.
Yeah, we could use that every election where, you know, he's approached by this woman supporter and during one of his campaigns against Dwight Eisenhower. And the woman says, "Governor, every thinking person will be voting for you." "Madam, that's not enough," Stevenson replied. "I need a majority."
Well, I wonder if politicians by nature or inclination are particularly good at what most people only wish they'd said.
No, I don't think most politicians are. I think there's a small group of politicians who are very good at this. And it comes probably through seasoning. It comes from paying attention, and it comes from a heart that's a little darker than others.
Well, because this goes back so far, there's not a lot of women who, you know, show up with comebacks. And one comeback by a famous woman senator is quite funny, but it also shows how far, in a sense, we've come. It's Senator Margaret Chase Smith of Maine. Now, we're talking what year approximately?
Oh, it must be in the 40s?
Right.
And someone asked Senator Margaret Chase Smith of Maine, what would you do if you woke up and found yourself in the White House? I would go to the president's wife, Mrs. Smith said, apologize, and then leave at once.
And of course, she was joking. She was a senator.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that line really works anymore.
Some of the really classic comebacks date back to the 19th century and some of our earlier politicians. And one of them involved Henry Clay running into another lesser-known politician, a Congressman John Randolph of Virginia.
Yeah, these were two great egos. And in the early years of Washington, D.C., the city was made up of wooden houses and muddy streets. And these two rivals, Randolph and Clay, meet on a narrow plank, and one would have to step into the mud. And Randolph stood his ground and glared at Clay. I will not give way for a scoundrel, he said. Clay bowed and smiled and stepped off the board. I will, he said.
And it takes you just a moment. It's like, and then... Right.
Well, yeah, those are the nice ones because they're like a little stiletto and they sort of stab you in the stomach and you don't know for a second that you've been stabbed.
The donkey is tired and thin. The elephant thinks he'll move in. They yell and they fuss, but they're not fooling us. They're sisters under the skin because it's the same old merry-go-round.
The book is I'll Be Sober in the Morning, Great Political Comebacks, Put-Downs, and Riposts by Chris Lamb. And there's more political put-downs at NPR.org.
You want to end up safe and sound, get off of the merry-go-round. To be a real smarty, just join a new party and keep your 2 feet on the ground.
When the credit crisis hit last year, the billionaire George Soros took himself out of semi-retirement. He'd focused less in recent years on making money and more on spending money to change the world. He had nonprofits and charities, and he was a major opponent of President Bush's re-election in 2004. But in 2007, Soros retook personal control of his investment funds.
It's the worst, most serious crisis of our lifetime.
George Soros says he's come out okay. So far. But he considers the financial crisis a symptom of a much larger problem, and his voice is now added to our series of conversations about the economy. Soros offers his latest analysis in a book called The New Paradigm for Financial Markets. Essentially, he argues with a basic economic theory. He does not believe in the collective wisdom of the markets. Free market thinkers believe that when millions of people all make their own best decisions, all those actions add up to the best possible economy. That belief in the market is why the U.S. has reduced government regulation for decades. But George Soros contends there's a problem with this theory. People pass bad information to one another until the whole crowd makes bad choices.
The idea was that regulators always make mistakes. State interference in the markets just messes things up. And that was a false idea because the first part of it is correct. The regulators are human and bound to make mistakes. But markets are also human. And they are also bound to make mistakes. Instead of markets always being right, they're actually always groping at trying to find out what the facts are, but they never get it right.
Are you saying that in the same way that the housing market turned out to be overpriced, people were just paying more than things were worth, and now they're paying the penalty for that? Are you saying that America, as an investment, is overpriced?
No, I'm not saying that. I am saying that America has, in the last 25 years, sucked up the savings of the rest of the world and consumed it and issued a large number of IOUs. These IOUs are now held in the central banks of China and other Asian exporting countries, Japan also, and oil producers. And they're worried about it, that there's too much. They don't want to hold them anymore. And there isn't any good alternative to holding dollars. So actually they set up sovereign wealth funds.
That countries try to invest in different places.
Frequently. That's right. And this is actually one of the factors that has fueled energy prices, commodity prices, and more recently food prices, which is actually setting up inflationary pressures at the same time as the country is on the verge of a recession. So you have a recession and inflation at the same time. That's why this crisis is different from the previous ones.
You know, when you talk about Americans spending so much money and so many dollars going overseas, in the shorter term, are Americans losing power as they accumulate more debt that they owe to people overseas?
Undoubtedly, wealth is power. As, for instance, China is becoming much more powerful than it was and is much more of a factor in the global economy. And they are now investing in Africa, in Asia. The once dominant role of the United States is now diminishing. And that is one of the factors why the value of the dollar as the undoubted reserve currency is now in question. Oil-producing countries now prefer to keep their reserves underground in the form of oil rather than to bring it out and convert it into holdings of dollars.
To the extent you can tell us, based on whatever information you publicly disclose, have you been betting on the dollar to keep going down or to go up at some point?
Well, basically, I've been negative on the dollar, although I think that in the near term, it may have gone too far. You see, the financial markets are full of uncertainty. They are much more uncertain than we think. Economics has been based on the model of natural science. But social events have a different structure because of the role of thinking participants who can't base their decisions on knowledge, but have to have a certain bias.
Well, now, you're touching on something that's been discussed a lot in recent months. The phrase that's often thrown about is pricing risk. For example, if I'm a banker, how high an interest rate do I want to charge to allow for the possibility that some of my loans won't be paid back? And people realize that they were pricing risk too low, far too low in recent months. That leads to this question, though. When you look at the markets today, do you think that people are still underpricing risk, still too optimistic about the odds of success in most investments?
That happens to be my view of the market. But of course, I may be wrong also. Just because I have this different theory, it doesn't mean that I'm right, because what I'm saying is that we are all wrong, and that includes me. But I do think we have now passed through the acute phase of the credit crunch, and markets are currently breathing a sigh of relief. But the fallout in the real world and the real economy is yet to be felt, and that is not yet actually reflected in the markets. So I am actually more pessimistic about the stock market than the market itself.
Well, if regulation of the markets doesn't work so well because human beings, human regulators screw up, and if the markets don't necessarily work so well because they're also run by humans who collectively screw up, what answer is left other than short selling a lot of stock?
No, I think financial markets are very, very flexible. They can adjust to changing circumstances. The fact that they are imperfect should not push us to abandon or constrain markets too much. We have gone overboard abandoning regulation. We mustn't go overboard abandoning markets. So while I see the dangers, I also am basically optimistic that we can learn and we can understand things better.
The new book from George Soros is called The New Paradigm for Financial Markets. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
And you can read an excerpt from his book, The New Paradigm for Financial Markets, at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Here's another man of many talents, Brian Unger, in his report today, What to Do with Your SUV.
now that it's bigger than your bank account. Here's humorist Brian Unger.
We're all hurting at the gas pump, but some are hurting more than others. Take a look at the car, rather the SUV and the driver, the one traveling next to yours. It may seem awkward, I know, but if you can hear my voice, fix your gaze upon that Range Rover next to you, stare into the eyes of that ranger who loves to rove or blaze that trail, cruise this land or tundra or whatever terrain that mountaineer, explorer, navigator, pathfinder of this great Montero of ours fancies. That person there stuck in traffic next to you. Look at them, raise your hand, the hand without a cell phone in it, and point with your index finger and mouth the words, "Bet you feel kinda silly." Now toss your head back, laugh a little like you're gloating, then poke your finger in their direction again. Go ahead, poke, poke, poke. One more head toss, one more laugh, kind of like a chortle. Now freeze. Okay, now make a frown face, stick out your bottom lip, and tilt your head slightly. Now drive away before they get out of their car and beat the living snot out of you. NPR listening, hybrid driving Samaritans. The person in that giant car filling your rearview mirror is hurting badly and needs compassion, not ridicule. They just filled up their tank and emptied their wallet with incredible speed, 0 to $60 in 8 seconds flat. That's pretty fast. And a steep price to pay for the confidence of knowing that when a blizzard hits Vegas, you've got four-wheel drive to weather the storm. To find a way out of this mess per gallon, here, a few things you can do with your SUV now that you can't afford to drive it. Live in it. Cheaper than an apartment. Finally, a mobile home that doesn't make you feel trashy or gauche. Turn it into a planter. Now, an SUV makes a terrific greenhouse. Convert your dome light to a grow light. Plant some tomatoes. It's a terrarium. Now, that's doing something really green. Use your SUV to transport other people. Follow those overcrowded buses and help out an overburdened public transportation system by giving folks a ride. Now, turn your SUV into a child care center or nursery school. Many parents are in need of good child care that comes to them in any kind of weather condition. Lastly, and perhaps the most important thing you can do with your SUV, help heal a divided Democratic Party by driving an Obama supporter and a Clinton supporter around the block until they can come to terms. I'm sure Howard Dean will reimburse you for the gas. And that is today's Unger Report. I'm Brian Unger.
Our humorist Brian Unger is here every Monday on Day to Day. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Chadwick.
On Mondays, we talk about technology during the Business Report, and today we're going to look at a new device aimed at helping people become more aware of their driving habits. In particular, driving habits that waste gasoline, like speeding or stepping on the brakes too hard. Hundreds of drivers in Denver are using this gadget as part of a test. And from Colorado Public Radio, Zachary Barr has the story.
In the 80s teen movie License to Drive, Corey Haim is Les Anderson, a teenager desperate to get his driver's license.
Buckle up, son. It's the real world out here.
When Les Anderson's at the DMV, the examiner gets into the car and places a hot cup of coffee on the dashboard.
Now that coffee's hot, filled right to the brim. If it spilled on me, probably burned me, huh? Speak up, son.
Yeah.
Nobody likes to get burned, do they?
No.
The examiner then declares exactly how he'll score Anderson's driving test.
So it's real simple. You burn me, you fail. You don't, you pass. It's as simple as that.
Well, right now in Denver, a similar sort of driving test is taking place. The goal of this test, though, is learning that your aggressive driving behavior, say, the kind that makes you spill a cup of coffee, is linked to excessive fuel use. Ron Adamczyk is one of a couple hundred volunteers to sign up for the pilot program called Driving Change.
Kind of three areas of aggressive driving. One is over speed, over 60 miles per hour, hard braking, and fast starts.
When Adamczyk brakes too abruptly or takes a corner too quickly, a device in his pickup sends data to a website. And today, he's online checking out his driving stats for the first time.
So we could see a few days ago, I drove approximately 22 miles, and then also showing me my number of events for aggressive driving. So on that day a few days ago, I had three hard braking events.
This information is important to Adamczyk. He says the folks running the program claim a 10 to 30% fuel savings is possible just by adjusting driving habits. Adamczyk's truck gets about 12 miles to the gallon around town, so he's especially keen to save money on gas. David Armitage is the CEO of Cartesite, the company that makes the hardware.
This was the first attempt anywhere on the planet that we're aware of to correlate driving behavior to greenhouse gas emissions.
Collecting data from several hundred vehicles is key. That's because the program's goal goes beyond just rating individuals. Armitage says the data will help define aggressive driving.
The goal of her study is really to enable us to define that shape of that bell curve and understand what normal behavior is. Once we've done that, we will take that information and we can put it right back into the device.
A device that will tell you if you're braking more, speeding more, or even idling more than the average driver. At that point, Armitage and his partners hope to have a product to sell.
We believe that the next generation of this device will actually be inside the cab of the vehicle and will have a small screen on it.
That's still a ways off. In the meantime, Ron Adamczyk says just knowing the device is watching over him makes a difference.
You know, I know now the light's red to glide to the stop. I know that my rapid starting, I'm not usually first in line, so that's not going to help. I would say my driving habit has improved in 10 days just by knowing this is installed in my car.
He says even improving merely a mile or two per gallon would be great. And he's not ready to trade in his truck just yet. For NPR News, I'm Zachary Barr.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Troy Maxson is a home run king in the Negro Baseball League. He believes racism cost him the chance to play in the majors. The story of this bitter man is told in August Wilson's drama Fences. It won the 1987 Pulitzer Prize. Troy Maxson has been compared to some of theater's most powerful and tormented leading men.
Troy Maxson is Othello, Macbeth, Willie Loman combined.
And we're focusing on Troy Maxson today for our series In Character. You just heard Kenny Leon speaking. He's a prominent director of August Wilson plays. The actor who originated the role on Broadway is James Earl Jones. NPR's Allison Keyes spoke with Jones about his all-time favorite fictional character.
James Earl Jones has been Othello, and he's played many other iconic roles, from boxer Jack Johnson in The Great White Hope to King Lear to Darth Vader. But Jones has great affection for Troy Maxson, a man he describes as a very hungry person.
That doesn't forgive everything he does or says, because he's very cruel also. But it allowed me to like him, you know. It allowed me to love him. He's a man who's wanting.
That wanting leads Troy into gut-wrenching problems. He destroys his son's chance at a college football scholarship, believing whites won't let Corey play. Then there's Troy's infidelity with a Florida gal with hips as wide as the Mississippi, after 18 years of marriage to Rose.
The reason he has the affair is because he just wants, and his wife cannot give him all he wants, and that's a psychic hunger that was developed in his childhood with his father in the South and on the farm, and developed in prison, developed in the baseball world that he occupied for a while.
Troy Maxson served 15 years in prison for murder before meeting Rose and taking a job as a garbage man in Pittsburgh. Now he, like so many other poor blacks in 1957, struggles to eke out an existence in a city that doesn't embrace them. Still, Troy's a captivating man despite his challenges. In the 1987 Broadway production of Fences, actress Mary Alice's Rose laughs while Troy tells a friend how he courted her.
Look here, Bono. When I met this woman, got out of that place, said, hitch up my pony, saddle my mare. There's a woman out there for me somewhere. Look here, look there. Saw Rose and latched on to her. I latched on to her and told her, I'm going to tell you the truth. Told her,
baby.
I don't want to marry. I just wants to be your man. And she told me, tell him what you told me, Rose.
I told him if he wasn't the marrying kind, then move out the way so the marrying kind could find me.
That's I think August may have written that part for James Earl Jones.
Actress Tamara Tooney saw James Earl Jones in the original Fences production and thinks Jones looks like the Troy August Wilson envisioned. Wilson described Troy as a man striving to fill out his largeness and wrote that Troy's size and blackness informed his sensibilities and the choices he made in life.
When I saw James Earl Jones on Broadway, he looked like he was, you know, 7 feet tall and just took up the entire stage.
Tooney played Troy Maxson's wife, Rose, in the recent Kennedy Center production and says Troy Maxson has an irresistible everyman spirit.
As Rose, even when we were fighting and arguing, I just love that man.
Tooney says that's one of the reasons Rose doesn't leave when Troy has the affair. Rose, she explains, buried her own hopes and dreams and accepted her husband's flaws because that's what one does in a marriage.
It has nothing to do with Rose or his relationship with Rose, or I think his relationship with any particular woman. I think Troy is, as you said, hungry, and I think he's very dissatisfied with life and the position that he has been put in because he was a black man in the 50s. And so I think it's really his anger and bitterness at life's disappointments that cause him to do the things that he does.
Again, Fences director Kenny Leon.
He has an honesty that most people don't have. I mean, when his wife says to him, Troy, all I want to know is, are you going to leave this woman? And he says, I can't do it. You know, I sit up in her house and she makes me laugh. That's a man who didn't have to say that. He goes, yeah, I'm going to leave this woman alone. But he doesn't because he can't. He is a very honest, direct, complex, flawed character.
Not only does Troy confess his affair to Rose, he then asks her to raise the other woman's baby after she dies in childbirth. James Earl Jones still remembers how the audience reacted.
And I'm in front of the audience and they're laughing and he's a great storyteller. But once I bring the bastard child home, especially the women in the audience began to hate me. True. And they began to talk back at me. They began to say, drown the damn baby. Words like that would come from the audience.
Rose agrees to raise the baby, but tells Troy he's a womanless man. Along with the fallout from Troy's affair, the Maxons also must deal with the smoldering tension between Troy and his son Corey. One can feel it, like a disease eating away at the family's foundation. In this scene from the 1987 Tony Awards broadcast, Troy's son is played by Courtney B. Vance.
How come you ain't never liked me?
Liked you? Who in the hell ever said, I got to like you?
Troy orders Corey to come stand in front of him.
Ask your question. What law is there to say, I got to like you?
None.
All right then.
Troy doesn't provide for his son because he likes him.
It is my job. It is my responsibility. You understand that? A man got to take care of his family. You live in my house. You sleep your behind on my bedclothes. You put my food in your belly because you are my son. You are my flesh and blood, not because I like you. It is my duty to take care of you. I owe a responsibility to you. Wait now. Let's get this straight right now. But go along any further. I ain't got to like you. Mr. Rand, don't give me my money come payday because he liked me. He give me because he owed me. Now, I didn't give you everything I had to give you. I gave you your life. Your mama and me worked it out between us. And liking your black ass was not a part of the bargain. And don't you try and go through life worried if somebody like you or not. You best make sure that they are doing right by you. You understand what I'm saying, boy?
Yes, sir.
Certainly we know those men who have been brought up, in a very hard and difficult life, and the way that they show love is not the way that you would expect it.
Actress Tamara Tooney says Troy is only trying to keep his son from suffering the same disappointments the father went through.
That is how he expresses his love. And so you have to see beyond the surface and the harshness of the words and really listen to what he's saying. And I think Troy Maxson is a remarkable man. And certainly, you know, I have met those kinds of men who you think are so harsh and bitter and angry. And it's really, you know, from a deep place of disappointment.
James Earl Jones believes the reason Troy's story resonates is that August Wilson's words paint a deft portrait that's familiar to everyone, regardless of race. Jones says Troy Maxson is so universal that his story and that of his family will be eternal. Allison Keyes, NPR News.